Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, our biggest Pixel 6 leak to date. We will go over every nook and cranny of all of these leaked renders. This one is a doozy, and we'll probably spend quite a bit of the show talking about it. So I'm excited. We'll also talk a little bit about rumors that Samsung will be putting Wear OS on its upcoming Galaxy Watch wearables. Why do these rumors exist? We'll sort of
get into
the...
Because they're awesome.
We'll get into the backstory. We'll talk a little bit about some a new processor from MediaTek and whether it can take on the Qualcomm incumbent. And we'll get into a few reviews. The new Amazon Echo Buds 2nd Gen are out, and they're pretty damn good. And two new Asus phones that are surprising in a couple of opposing ways. And if we have time, we'll talk about just a few niche things and something called Matter, because apparently Matter matters. And then Google I.O. is next week. So if you stay tuned, we will give you a quick Google I.O. preview. All right. That voice you heard before was Ara Wagner. Welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Is your microphone going to work today?
I'm hoping. I plugged it into a USB hub and then plugged the hub into the Surface Pro 3. Because yes, I still use the Surface Pro 3 to record the podcast.
All right. Well, we'll hope for the best. Jerry Hildenbrand, how's your microphone doing today?
Not loud enough.
Yeah, never is. And all the way across the pond, Alex Dobie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been a good few weeks since I was last on here, so good to be back.
Yeah, you are in, I guess we'll start with you. You're in possession of these two Asus phones. We'll talk about that a bit later. But I wanted to talk to you as well about the kind of bombshell Pixel 6 leaks that John Prosser dropped yesterday. Now, caveat here, a couple weeks ago, we talked about how Android Central was involved in a Pixel 5a leak that ended up not being entirely accurate. It started with John Prosser, so one has every reason to be skeptical that the thing that he is reporting is not necessarily accurate. Except this is, we have it on very good authority that these Pixel 6 renders are accurate. They've been backed up by Max Weinbach, who is also known for his accuracy. We can independently confirm that these are accurate. So we'll just say that. Obviously, all leaks have to be just blasted with salt, but we can say that what you're seeing is pretty close, if not exactly what we're going to get later this year from Google. So with that out of the way, let's talk about these actual renders. So this is a massive departure. And if you haven't seen these renders yet, I highly encourage you to go to AC or basically any blog, because we all reported it yesterday, and look at these. It's very different, Alex, from what we've seen in the past, right? Just off the bat, the front of the phone has a in-display fingerprint sensor. It's a little bit it's a little bit boxier than previous Pixels. It seems to have a taller aspect ratio, though we can't really tell exactly the screen size. And there seem to be two models, one with a two camera setup and a three camera setup, which we assume will be a Pixel 6 and a Pixel 6 Pro or Plus or whatever it's going to be called. And this really interesting all black band that covers these cameras with a hefty bump to showcase larger sensors. So walk us through kind of the high level, what we know right now about the Pixel 6s based on these renders.
So the big sort of high level takeaway from this, I think, is we're going back to premium Pixels. I don't think there's any way around that. This is not going to be what we had last year with the Pixel 5 and the 4a 5G. This is going to be very much targeted at the high-end segment. You've got three cameras, you've got very slim bezels. You've got this design which is built around making space for those larger sensors. And, you know, we can say we've also heard independently that, yes, there will be larger sensors in this thing. It's not going to be the sixth year of that same sensor they've been using since 2016. So, and also you can tell in terms of the branding that's being used, right? Pixel 6 and Pixel 6 Pro, those are also names we've heard independently. And it points to kind of a return to the old, okay, small phone plus big phone dynamic, but also the, you know, a Pro Pixel, right? A high-end phone from Google that is probably going to go up against, you know, pick any like $1,000 phone that is on the market right now. And from the look of these renders, from the screen borders, from the number of cameras around the back, from the, just the design in general, this looks like a premium phone. It doesn't look as basic as a lot of the past sort of couple of years of Pixels have looked. So I'm pretty excited. I think this is going to be, you know, the Pixel line kind of has pivoted a lot over the past couple of years. Google didn't really seem to know what they wanted to make it. Seems this year they're sort of turned back towards, okay, let's make premium phones and let's just put the best hardware out there that we can. And I'm, yeah, looking forward to seeing what they do with this thing.
So I have a crazy theory to throw out there. And again, I have no idea if this is true, but is it possible that the Pixel 5 was sort of cobbled together as a solution for 2020, in the sense that Google understood that people's budgets were under pressure, that it wasn't a good idea. And we've heard from Rick Osterloh in interviews around the release of the Pixel 5 that perhaps that was the strategy. People don't really have $1,000 to spend on a phone, so let's release one that costs significantly less than that. And when I say cobbled together, obviously I don't mean it was put together in a couple of weeks, but given the fact that the Pixel 5 is so close to the Pixel 4a 5G in specs, could this Pixel 6 be the phone that Google initially wanted to release last year and couldn't, and wanted to skip, you know, spend an extra year putting together the best possible flagship that it could? Or do you think this was the plan all along?
I'm not really sure. So there are a couple of things to break down there. First of which is that there was a lot of sort of narrative last year that the Pixel 5 was the way it was because of the pandemic. That's not true. The Pixel 5 design and specs were locked in way before COVID-19 started.
Okay.
So, yeah, the specs were leaking out in January. You know, these things were doing the rounds internally at Google on AOSP. So that's, we can pretty much discount that. As for, you know, was there work going on the Google Silicon GS101 before then that maybe wasn't quite ready yet? So they decided to put it back a year. That's possible, I think. Maybe the chip for this phone just wasn't ready on time. They didn't really want to license something else from Qualcomm or whoever. They decided to just go with a Pixel 5 instead. That could have been a decision that was made perhaps towards the end of 2019. I could see that happening. That's just speculation though, and it could equally be that, you know, after the Pixel 4 kind of failed, Google just took a couple of years to, you know, they played it really safe last year and then, you know, took the year to sort of do a bit of soul searching and figure out exactly what they wanted to do with their next proper high-end Pixel. I think that's perhaps a little bit more likely. And I think that, you know, the narrative of, oh, here's a cheap phone because it's COVID and no one has any money, that works pretty well. It, you know, as a line in an interview, I don't think it's particularly, you know,
it's a happy accident.
Yeah, it's a happy accident.
Right. I think it's a cheap phone because Google knows that's the only phones they can sell. I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, compare Pixel 4 sales to Pixel 4a sales. If I was in charge of the money and counting the beans, I would say no, make another Pixel 4a.
But that's not what they're doing. I mean, this...
Yeah,
you look at these renders,
the 5.
Yeah, yeah. But if you look at what they're doing this year, there's no way this is going to be a cheap phone.
I don't know. I can make renders too. I won't believe anything what it looks like until I see a picture of it on the bus.
Mm.
I mean, let's assume that these are real. So, you know, let's actually just go through the design a little bit. So this is a huge departure from what Google's done in the past. No more, really no more bezels on the front of the phone at all. They're really, really tiny, if they're at all. There's a centered hole punch camera similar to a Samsung phone. I mean, this really does, for all intents and purposes, look like a Galaxy Note from the front.
It's a Samsung phone on the front and a Nexus 6P on the back.
Right. And so this back dual tone finish, we have renders in this sort of orange with the top of the phone having that splash of color, and then a more muted tone on the, you know, below it. The if I'm looking at a pair of renders with the Pixel 6 and Pixel 6 Pro or Plus, whatever it'll be called, the smaller phone has a narrower top bezel. The camera module is closer to the top, and then it looks like there's more of a white finish, whereas the larger phone, there's more space between the camera and the top bezel. That splash of color is larger, and then there seems to be more of like a champagne-y style color. We're not sure if the back of the phone is glass or metal or plastic. It's probably glass if it follows the trends of other premium devices. But Alex, obviously the big deal here is the fact that this will be, at least on the larger phone, a Pixel with a triple camera setup. What do we know about that camera setup right now? Or what can we accurately speculate?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit difficult just going off the stuff in these renders. What we can probably say is there's no periscope in there, just because the layout of the lenses, the look of the lenses themselves probably wouldn't be spaced to do that anyway with a triple camera. I would bet that if Google was going to do two lenses in a smaller Pixel, it would probably go ultra wide and wide, and then you'd have an extra telephoto, probably like a 3x or something, in the Pixel 6 Pro. Like I said before, we do know a little bit about the sensors of these things that we've been able to sort of discern through our own sources, and you know there will be a much larger main sensor in this, in at least the Pixel 6 Pro, we can say. So, but other than that, it's going to be, obviously the hardware is important, but just as important, you know, what can this camera setup do with 100% top to bottom Google Silicon? That's going to be the key thing, I think, in terms of what makes this next generation, you know, the biggest upgrade ever to a Pixel camera. What makes that special? That's going to be in the Google Silicon and in the Google software.
Yeah, if you bought a Pixel for the camera, I would sit out a few months. There's a very good chance this is going to be a little bit, I hate to use the word buggy, but maybe doesn't perform as well.
Wait a minute. Google's going to release a phone that's going to be buggy?
Well, I hate to use that word because it's not necessarily buggy. It's, you got to get it out in the world and see what needs tweaked on the software side with new camera sensors and a new path to, you know, take the photo information. That's a lot of stuff that there's bound to be something in there that needs adjustment.
It'll be a little rough and it'll need a few optimizations as the first few months of Pixel drops go by.
At the same time, this has been in the works for years. If we're to believe the sources that claim Google's been testing its silicon in labs, you know, for at least, you know, the last couple of years. They've likely had, I'm not saying it won't be rough around the edges, but the Pixel 5, you know, it was basically like the perfect Zeppelin, right? It was the best version of the old way of doing things.
Right.
And it just feels like we've reached the physical end of the limitations. But at the same time, Google has been iterating on those software algorithms, its HDR plus algorithms for years now. And one would speculate that dropping it into, you know, at least one new sensor, if not two, I'm assuming the ultra wide sensor will be pretty similar to what was found on the Pixel 5. But that primary sensor, if they're testing thousands, millions of photos with it, I would think by now those would be mature enough to come out of the gate pretty well formed. I don't know. I don't see this being as buggy as, say, the Pixel 2 or Pixel 3. But Google will surprise us, I'm sure.
I would just say look at all the hacked versions of Gcam that have been on so many phones over the years, and you can get pretty good results even if you're not Google, if you're just someone on XDA hacking the APK to work on whichever phone you have. So I think, yeah, it's the whole thing is mature enough that probably it's going to be better than we expect out the gate.
And I mean, to be fair, it's not just the cameras we potentially have to worry about being a little bit rough out the gate. This is going to be the first phone with Google's silicon. I'm sure there's going to be some wonk around that as well that needs optimization.
That is true. That is definitely true, Ara. Plus,
especially when the two of those combine when it comes to camera processing.
You can test for 20 years with 10 people testing, and that doesn't mean that things will work when you put it in the hands of a million people.
Mm. Oh, that's a
t-shirt right there.
That's a nice estimate for sales.
Well,
that's a generous estimate.
I don't know. 1 million. I'm sure they sold a million Pixel 4s.
I know. I'm just joking. I
know.
I feel like they probably sold a couple million Pixel 4s.
They'll never get back to their glory days of the original Pixel where they sold, what, 5 million?
Yeah. Never say never. But at the same time, I'm not a terribly huge fan of this design just because the camera bump being all the way across the back and raised up so significantly means either I'm going to have to put a really thick case on this in order to get it flush, or it's just never going to sit flat on a desk and the camera bump is going to be just so ridiculously exposed.
It's going to be very linty, is what it's going to
be. It looks
like
the most Google thing ever. I'm not going to lie. It looks exactly like something that would come from Google. The colors.
I hate those colors.
Yeah. It just screams Google to me. But I have, you know, been doing this long enough and seen so many things that everybody's sure this is what it is. And then when it really comes, that wasn't what it is at all. I have to be skeptical of anything until I actually see it.
What if the colored section on the back is actually some kind of crazy e-ink that adapts to the color of your
Alex,
wallpaper? Like the
hang up. You're done. No, Alex isn't allowed on the podcast anymore.
It's that EVT stuff that OnePlus showed us a couple of years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be really cool, but then that means that the top of your phone is going to clash with the rest of the back, unless the Google logo is that e-ink as well.
Mm, could be.
But also, I don't like the reddish orange. I don't like that champagne colored back. Just get the green this year was perfect. Give me another green. Give
it's
me
ugly
a
as
blue.
Hell.
Give me a good purple.
It's fruitless to argue about colors at this point. We have absolutely no idea what SKUs will be available.
And I think
all
Max
we know
Weinbach
is that
saying,
one way or the other, Ara will be disappointed. But
it's going to be black.
That is a certainty. Yeah, there will be a black version. I hope it's not glossy.
I mean, if they give us a tuxedo or like stormtrooper version, I'm okay with that. But that red is just not great.
But I think anyone disappointed by the colors, probably, I think Max Weinbach was saying that the design is correct, but the colors in those renders isn't. So perhaps take that with a pinch of salt.
My guess is that he's saying that the colors in the render are exaggerated, not that they're incorrect.
Right.
So that it's not quite as orange as it looks in the renders.
I want to get on Twitter and just say something. Just say something and see how many people repeat it.
Well, if 90,000 people follow you, then maybe a lot of people will repeat it.
But that's where we're at right now. I don't want to rehash anybody's track record on leaks because leaks are leaks. Sometimes you purposefully get shown the wrong thing or you see something that was old and scrapped. But right now we're at the render stage and I don't have any confidence in any render, even if it, you know, had Google NFT and they owned it or something. I hate renders.
I get it. Look, I do. And we wouldn't be reporting this if we didn't think it was accurate. If this was just another fly-by-night render and we didn't actually have our own reasons to think it was accurate, we wouldn't have been talking for the last 10 minutes.
I know. But, and we could be wrong too. I've been wrong plenty of times and I don't know. It's hard for me to get hyped because I like the design. I like the colors. I like what I see. I hope that the phone looks like that and I don't want to be disappointed. So I'm tempering my expectations.
Understood. Yeah, I get it. But what I'm also saying here is this is a huge departure for Google, right? This is going back 2 years to a small big. It's going to be the first time that Google's going to put a triple camera setup in its phone. It's going to be the first time in 5 years that they've increased the sensor size of its camera. It's going to have its own, it's going to be the first phones running Google Silicon. It will probably launch alongside the Pixel Watch, which we haven't talked about this week, but we expect it to arrive alongside the Pixel 6 series. We're also expecting next week to see a big change to the visual language of Android 12, right? There may be some massive Wear OS-based announcements too. So to say that this is going to be a big year for Google hardware is an understatement. And I think what Alex mentioned at the beginning, it really did seem like the Pixel 5 in 2020 itself was just a blip year for Google's hardware division. Whether it was pandemic related or not, seems like it was just coincidence that they decided to do cheap in a year where cheap was the right move. But this is really going back to premium in a way that we haven't seen for a very long time.
Yeah, I really couldn't be happier to see that move, because I have the black Pixel 5 in my hand right now, comparing it to the champagne Pixel 6 Pro in these renders. And it really is a dramatic change from year to year if this is what we're going to get.
I mean, there's not a whole lot more we can say about it. I'm sure more leaks will come out.
I had one question here. Among the specs and reporting that we've been able to try and cobble together for the Pixel 6, this is the first one that looks like it's going to have the in-screen fingerprint sensor. Do we know if that's going to be optical, or if they're going to, if they made some kind of deal with Sam, or if they're going to use the ultrasonic the way that Qualcomm. Samsung does?
So the ultrasonic is Qualcomm. So I would guess
it won't be Qualcomm's.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it won't be Qualcomm, if only because the ultrasonic sensor sucks, even on the second gen. It's just
bad. And this is why I ask, because I'm like, I when I was reviewing the A52, I was just like, wow, I've kind of missed having an optical sensor over the ultrasonic, just because the optical, yeah, it lights up your it lights up your finger like ET, but at least the damn thing works.
I don't know. I mean, it's a really good question. Optical is... it's accurate, but from a biometrics perspective, it kind of is a regression, and it's a regression after a regression from a Google perspective, because the Pixel 4 series had just this seamless, beautiful 3D-based face unlock. Then the Pixel 5 went back to a rear capacitive sensor, which is super fast and we know works really well. But from a, just Jerry, like, back me up here, from a security perspective, Qualcomm's ultrasonic sensor is more secure.
Oh, yeah, that's why it's less accurate.
But from Google's perspective, which one do they prioritize here? Because I agree with Ara, right? Like, the ultrasonic isn't great, but having an optical sensor on it means that you get an accurate reading most of the time. And it's really fast. So which one does Google choose?
Yeah, I'll bet internally there are two different camps. If I was on the Google hardware team, I'd go with the optical, because it works better. It'll make users more happy. And it's, you know, 90% as secure. And, you know, Google's not afraid to tell you that a fingerprint isn't really secure. And here's how you can quickly disable it if you need to lock your phone.
And does Google just do that? I mean, does it just, like, just last week, Google said that they want to end the password. They're turning on two-factor authentication by default for all accounts. They are trying to do stuff with biometrics that no other company except Apple is really taking effort to do. The idea of them just throwing an optical, like a regular optical sensor on the Pixel 6 doesn't seem likely to me.
I agree, but then I think, you know, an optical sensor can be fooled if you're in a laboratory and have a way to resin print an exact duplicate of a fingerprint. You could buy a resin printer for your home, but it's not near high enough resolution to do that. That's something to remember. Out in the wild, it's a lot more secure than it is in a lab. I'm going to guess that it's probably an optical sensor, and that's good enough.
Yeah, I don't know. Something tells me that Google's going to have an accompanying and biometrics-based announcement.
Google has been working on auditory biometrics for a long time. You know, your phone knows your voice. Your phone knows where you're at based on its location. All that can be combined to make sure it's really you. And then if you can prove that with a fingerprint, that's pretty damn secure.
We will see.
And then your phone's always listening in your pocket, so.
Yeah, I mean, and again, like Google may do stuff with the Pixel Watch, right? If you're wearing the Pixel Watch, it may do sort of passive authentication.
UWB, ultra wideband.
Like the Apple Watch, yeah. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about the rumors of the Samsung dropping Tizen for Wear OS, the new Galaxy Watch 4 will probably launch alongside the Galaxy S21 FE and whatever foldables are coming out later this year, probably in August. There's an expectation that Samsung will ditch Tizen, move to Wear OS. We don't know a ton about this yet, but I think even the speculation that's out there right now is that Tizen is good for what it is, but it seems to be dead in the water. And if Samsung is going, and we've heard these rumors for months that Samsung is going to put out a watch that runs Wear OS, what does that mean for Samsung's wearable division as a, you know, we think of Wear OS as a pretty, like the hardware ecosystem surrounding Wear OS is pretty limited. It's only basically two companies, Fossil and Mobvoi. Oppo put out a Wear OS watch last year, but it didn't really make a splash. So with Samsung coming into the fold, what do they lose, Alex, and what do they gain?
Well, what they gain is probably a big pile of cash from Google, because that's the only way this kind of thing would happen.
And
app support. Yeah, exactly. And in that same vein, what they also lose is control, potentially, if Wear OS is going to continue to work the way it works right now. It's sort of, on the face of it, seems like just a business decision, but we'll have to see if there's more to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wearing a Galaxy Watch right now, and it's great for timers, it's great for fitness tracking, it's great for looking at my notifications, actually acting on any notifications, less great. But I mean, I just can't add any of the apps that I want to use, like the apps that I use when I wear a Wear OS watch. Like, I can't use Google Keep in order to see my grocery list. I can't have it tie into Google Pay so I can do tap and pay from my wrist. I have to use Samsung Pay instead. Tizen is a great little system, but I want more out of my watch than that. And without robust app support, Tizen is dead. And I think that's why Samsung might be considering moving over, because they've tried to incentivize it. They've tried to incentivize watch app development, and it just hasn't really gone anywhere.
You know, Tizen can run Android apps. That's not a reason to switch platforms.
I mean, Google, the earliest Galaxy, was it the Galaxy Watch Live?
The Gear Live.
Gear Live.
Sorry. It went from Wear OS to Tizen.
Yep.
Didn't it?
No, yep. That was the Galaxy Gear, the original Galaxy Gear.
Yeah, the first, whatever the first one was called.
The first one was the Galaxy Gear Live, and it was an Android Wear device, because it was one of the first ones that they gave out after Google I/O.
Yeah, the Gear Live launched on Wear OS and stayed on Wear OS. The that was like a year after the original Samsung Galaxy Gear, which launched on Android and then got upgraded to Tizen like a year later.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. It was never running Android Wear. It was running Android, right? Like Android.
Because Android Wear didn't exist back then.
Right. Yeah. That's what it was.
I, if this gets announced, I'm writing the article because I have the best headline. Samsung, welcome to Wear OS. The lifeboats are in the back.
if nothing else, this will get people talking about Wear OS again. And yeah. So,
hey,
according to the report,
Samsung has the best hardware for watches. bringing Wear OS and that app support could be the best of both worlds. Don't rain on my parade, Jerry. I want to believe. You know,
I do not like what Samsung has done with Tizen. I think they did a really bad job, and I wish IBM still had more control. But Tizen on a watch.
You mean Intel, not IBM.
Yeah, Intel. Tizen on a watch is a much better idea than Wear OS.
And also, something to consider is the hardware inside those watches, right? One of the reasons why Samsung's wearables are really good and performant and actually have good battery life is because they've been running Samsung's own silicon for basically as long as they've existed. Whereas on the Wear OS side, it's Google and it's Qualcomm, and neither one really wants to sort of take the incentive. And so you have a situation where until very recently, they were running these ancient SoCs.
They're still running the ancient SoCs.
Well, they're running even more ancient.
4100 is too expensive for anybody.
Right. I mean, so that's the cutting edge.
And it's still ancient.
Yeah, before then, you were basically running a Snapdragon 400 on a 28 nanometer process from like 2013. So, just as important as maybe Samsung picking it up will be the fact that this presumably will be a Wear OS watch running Google software on Samsung silicon.
Yeah, so this report actually talks about a Galaxy Watch 4 and a 4 Active. So Samsung skipped the Galaxy Watch Active 3 and went direct.
Make them both have them both having the same name makes it easier for them to say, okay, the Active is like the smaller, more streamlined one, and the Galaxy Watch 4 is going to be the more robust, the more powerful one. I'm perfectly fine with that. Give me the Watch Active 4.
According to the report, Samsung is switching to Wear OS because the apps are easier to develop for, which is interesting. Samsung has never really had developer support on Tizen, so that makes sense. Samsung's involvement could, quote, energize the Wear OS market. And Samsung will also be, quote, leading the charge in an expansion of Wear OS. This is from a translated Korean news report. That we're reading off 9to5 Google. So again, we're not sure what's going to be announced next week, but this is interesting. If Samsung and Google are now working together on a wearables platform, that could mean more companies would be likely to come back to the Wear OS fold and make wearables exciting again for Android.
Let's be honest. This is a way to save Wear OS.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a Hail Mary. 100% yeah, right. It's a Hail Mary. This is Google doing what it needs to do.
What it should have done years
there's
ago.
Nothing, yes. There was nothing else to do.
Google's had years to fix this on their own. It's time to call in a ringer, and that's going to be Samsung.
And it's kind of just the end point of the sort of schism that started with the device you're talking about a few moments ago, the original Galaxy Gear, moving from Android to Tizen, and now it's kind of come full circle.
I do like it. It's interesting that Google has sort of acknowledged that Samsung has won, and from at least an external perspective, it's almost like, all right, if we're going to beat Apple, we have to do this together. It's not so much Google versus Samsung versus Apple. It's like Apple's this specter. And it's winning all over the place in every category. Samsung is going to do its thing, building its hardware ecosystem. It's got its headphones. It's got its wearables. It's got, you know, its little trackers and everything that connects a Samsung phone to another Samsung phone or Samsung phone to other products. But from Android versus iOS perspective, Google is now playing the long game. And strategically working with Samsung to bring more Google services to the fore, making sure that Google Messages is on all Samsung devices, that the Discover feed is on Samsung phones by default, right? These small changes acknowledge that Google and Samsung need each other more than they don't.
Right.
And
I've seen so many takes that, you know, Samsung's going to save Google. We have to remember this benefits Samsung just as much. Google is better at software. Always has been, always will be. Insert your joke about the Pixel software bugs here, but still, Google does a better job at software than Samsung does. So more Google involvement there is better for Samsung. a watch. Let's say you stop running Tizen. That means all of a sudden now your watches have access to Google services.
Give me Google Assistant over Bixby on my watch. For the love of God, please.
Samsung could never. They wouldn't even do as good a job as Huawei to make their own services platform, because that's not what their company does. It would take them years to catch up. So this means they don't have to.
I think that's a good point. I think Samsung's biggest victory over the last couple of years is just tacitly acknowledging what it's not good at and leaving what it's not good at to other players, right?
Agreed. Is when it comes to consumer electronics, Samsung makes some of the best stuff you can buy, period. When it comes to software, Google is better.
But also Google has helped Samsung get better.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You've talked about this many times. Project right. Treble and Mainline have helped Samsung update its phones for longer. And that has in turn made it a more popular brand and a more consumer-friendly brand.
Right. It goes back to what you said. This Samsung gets better because it knows it can realize that, hey, this isn't our strong point. Let's get some help. And when it gets that help, the Samsung benefits as a company, and we benefit as consumers of Samsung products. So everybody wins here.
All right. Well, we will see next week because the keynote is on Tuesday. What we're going to do is have a podcast later that day, and we're going to go over everything that was announced at I/O. So stay tuned for that. Let's just talk quickly about this new MediaTek chip, another Dimensity branded product. It's sort of 5G mid-range, focusing on the, you know, probably $300 to $500 price point, but it's got a lot of cool things for that class of phone. It has 120 hertz refresh rate support. It can support camera sensors up to 108 megapixels. It can support up to a quad array. It does native HDR through the camera. It has a decent 4-core Mali GPU. It's got two Cortex A78 cores with paired with six Cortex A55 cores. So it's not quite as powerful as the flagship Dimensity 1200, but it's still built on a pretty efficient 6-nanometer process. Again, this is not something that we're necessarily going to see in North America, but the fact that MediaTek is more consistently challenging Qualcomm is a good thing.
Yep. This is a big turning point, maybe. This chip is cheaper and outperforms the Snapdragon 768.
Yeah.
So I think that's a bigger deal than people realize, that it actually outperforms a Qualcomm chip in its same class, which is a first, and it's really good to see, because that means Qualcomm's next, you know, they've already got, what, the 780, but the 788, 785, whatever they're going to call it, is going to be even better, because Qualcomm can't just sit still when this kind of thing is happening.
And we've already seen the results of sort of MediaTek becoming a stronger player in the right. device wins they've had for the Dimensity 1200. Not all of them have been announced yet, but we're looking at potentially the next big OnePlus Nord phone using that in the near future. And there have been plenty of other examples of that as well.
All right, so a few other quick news points. We saw our best leak yet of Sony's new WF-1000XM4 earbuds. These are going to have a flat bottom, which means that they're going to have wireless charging. The case is going to be significantly smaller, as are the buds themselves. That was my biggest criticism of the 1000XM3s. They're freaking massive. They are not portable for being true wireless earbuds, but they have the best, or among the best, active noise cancellation. If Sony can bring that to a much smaller package to actually compete with the, you know, AirPods Pro, Galaxy Buds Pro of the world, the product, I think, is going to be incredible. I'm really looking forward to it. We have pretty accurate live photos of these, so we know kind of what they're going to look like. They have a long tube that will make them really comfortable. They're certainly not small. We're not talking like Jabra Elite 75T small here, but they look considerably smaller than the previous version. No idea on price yet, but looking probably in the $200 range if the XM3s are anything to go by. and they're expected to launch in the summer, which means that they will likely launch retail alongside the Xperia 1 Mark III. So that is all we know about these. I'm super excited because I'm an earbud nerd, but I don't know about you guys.
They look interesting, but 200 is a little rich for my blood.
And we still don't know much about the Pixel A, Buds A, but we talked about that last week. They're definitely coming, likely at I.O. So a couple other hardware announcements. The Amazon announced a treasure trove of new Echo Shows, including a new Echo Show 5 and 8 and a new Echo Show 5 Kids. Amazon also yanked thousands of listings from popular accessory makers Aki and Empow, among other lesser-known brands, after it was discovered that these companies had been participating in a pay-to-play review program that would allow people to agree to keep products for in exchange for a positive review. This came after a database of all of these participants was leaked. Right now, you cannot buy an Aki product on Amazon. You cannot buy an Empow product on Amazon, at least not through Amazon's fulfillment itself. No idea when these are going to come back, but it's a pretty big deal. This was pretty incriminating. And it just undermines all of the Amazon reviews that you've read about these really popular products, right?
To me, it also undermines Amazon. I think everybody that's ordered a bunch of products from Amazon has gotten one, at least, that has a little card inside, tells you how to leave a review, and then tag us on social media, and here's a $5 gift certificate or something. A lot of companies do pay for good reviews, and that's bad, and Amazon should get rid of that. But Amazon picked its two biggest competitors to the Amazon Basics brand to put out front and yank away. That's not a good look. You know,
I mean, yeah, I'm especially disappointed that Aki got swept up in this, because Aki, honestly, their products are good enough. I don't know why they think they needed to pay for reviews, because Aki makes some of the best power delivery chargers and some of the best power banks on the market, especially for the price that they charge for it. Like, you didn't need to do this. Why? I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
It's that thing, though. If everybody's cheating, you almost have to cheat.
Well, that I would put more on Amazon, but yeah.
Maybe. I mean, they still shouldn't have done it.
That's it. Like, wrong, straight up. But I don't know whose decision it was to do this, but they were wrong. And they've hurt the rest of the company. Which sucks, because Aki's designers do good work.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely not the people building the products asking for the reviews. But the way that Amazon has set up its algorithm is that it does not necessarily reward the best products. It rewards the products with the most positive reviews. That is how Amazon encourages companies to market their stuff. Hey, this charger has over 10,000 4.5-star or 5-star reviews. We see it all the time. When they market their samples to us, hey, this GAN charger that looks identical and works identically to thousands of others on the Play Store, on the Amazon store, here's the reason why you should pick us over another company. It's because it has X number of positive reviews. It is more likely that we will believe a product's positive rating if there is a surfeit of really, really positive reviews, right? 5 or 10 reviews don't necessarily make you believe it, but 10,000, that's just it's hard to ignore. So
the problem being that unless your product has been out for like 2 years, 10,000 reviews just isn't practical, especially for anything technology related. We have turnover for this stuff. If I see something, if I'm looking at an accessory and I see that it has 5,000 reviews, I'm like, okay, that's either an old model or it's about to get updated.
Unless they paid for 5,000 reviews. There you go. See? Yeah. You're answering your own question.
I mean, it might be the cost of doing business for a company like Aki that has big enough cash flow. Then it's, you know, what this company is saying is that the bundles of 1,000 reviews cost about $11,000. So if you extrapolate that, right, how valuable is a single positive review? How valuable is a 1,000 positive reviews, right? Are you selling more than $11,000 of merchandise on the back of those reviews. And probably that's
and
that is
and your competitors are doing it.
It also has a shining effect on the other products that you release. If right. Aki has, you know, one of Aki's most popular products is like a $10,000 USB-C portable charger, right? $10,000 milliamp hour USB-C portable charger. You may buy that and really like it. That may have 20,000 positive reviews. A GaN charger that they sell for $10 may only have 10 or 15 positive reviews, but you trust the brand more because of that initial interaction with that listing. And that is the, you know, for a company like Aki that's releasing new products every week, that is a big deal. So I'm not really sure how they're going to solve this, right? If they reinstate all of these listings, how do they actually ensure that this doesn't happen again without completely overhauling?
Amazon needs to overhaul the review system, period. Like, we've seen this for years. Like, you can tell when people are either just spamming a review or when they're actually, when they genuinely like a product. But more importantly, reviews need to be weighted differently. And I honestly wish that once you get above like 100, 500, it doesn't show you the number of reviews that it has. Because I'm sorry, if you want people to stop juicing their numbers, don't show them. Just show the star rating. And then if somebody actually goes and looks through the reviews, then they can see how many or how few they are.
Right.
You're right. I mean, this doesn't matter to Amazon anyway, as far as for Amazon's business, because, you know, this product has 10,000 glowing reviews. But first, let me show you our product.
Amazon Basics chargers are inferior to the two companies that they just kicked off, which means that Amazon Basics is the de facto cheapo choice while these companies are blacklisted.
Yeah, that like I said earlier, that disappoints me, but that still doesn't, you know, that doesn't fix any of this. And that doesn't mean that these two companies shouldn't be punished for doing, you know, what they did. They got caught, whether everybody else does it or for whatever reason, they still got caught doing it. And you have to do something. They're not going to stay out of Amazon forever.
I'm hoping it's just a 7-day lockout and then they're back tomorrow and they're back on like Monday or Tuesday. But these are great products. They don't deserve to be relegated to the trash heap or left to be obscured on and only sold on Aki's website.
I completely disagree with you because Aki is a company. It's not, you know, sure, they make good products, but it's also they are responsible for this poor behavior. Not to mention the fact that Amazon is one retailer and it's partly our fault our fault as a culture, as a website, as a, like everything for pushing so many people to Amazon because it is so convenient. Amazon's dominance is kind of why Aki put itself in this position. So on the one hand, Aki is at fault here. Amazon is certainly to blame partially for putting these companies that rely on that have such tight margins on their products. They're giving Amazon a cut of every sale, obviously. It's just tough, but Aki should not have done this. Mpow should not have done this. It is objectively true that these companies need to be held responsible in some way. And it's not so much that Aki is to blame in like the sense that they were just doing what other companies were doing. But as a culture, Amazon is also very responsible for putting these much smaller dependent sellers in these positions. And it's also tough because we would like to diversify where we recommend people buy things. And yet telling somebody to buy something from Aki.com is really not tenable. Most people will just laugh that off and say no.
Yep.
So
they'll find something different at Amazon because it's easy.
Right. I mean, that's the difference, is that the commoditization of these products means that what's the difference between Aki, Anker, and, you know, RavPower? They all basically produce the same product.
About $30.
That exactly. It but you know that. Most people have no idea. And if they are searching for portable charger and Aki was number one and now it's no longer there, people are going to pick the Amazon choice number one, which is likely going to be RAV Power or Anker. They're not going to know the difference. Most people don't even know the difference between the two brands anyway. So it is absolutely Aki's problem, but it is also a problem that Amazon put them in.
And it's a problem that Amazon is responsible to fix, and they won't.
And they won't, because they don't have the same incentive to fix it, because by and large, it's sort of like this Apple Epic thing, right? Apple owns the ecosystem. They are requiring developers to adhere to those rules, even if those rules are absurd most of the time. And because of their dominance, these smaller developers have no choice. And Aki is not a small seller, but it is still a bit player when it comes to Amazon's entire business. All right, let's move on. I want to talk a little bit about these two Zenfone reviews, Alex. So walk us through these two products. We have the Zenfone 8, Zenfone 8 Flip, and you published these separately because they are really, really different phones. But give us the high-level overview of what we have here.
Yeah, it's a bit of a change for the Zenfone series, I think. Over the past couple of years, they've sort of, the differentiating feature has been the flip camera. That's what the entire series has been built around, as well as, you know, the change to software they made a couple of years ago. It's now super clean, you know, no bloatware, nothing like that. This time, things have changed up a little bit. So the rumored Zenfone 8 Mini has come to market as the Zenfone 8. That's pretty much, you know, you have the software that we all know from Asus phones, nice and clean, nice and fast, probably slower than we'd like with updates, but, you know, a lot better than most of the other manufacturers out there. But this one is kind of Asus's take on a high-end, small form factor phone. So it's about the same size as a Pixel 5, except it has all the technology in there you'd expect from a really high-end phone. Snapdragon 888, up to 16 gigs of RAM, dual SIM, water resistant. The only thing you don't get, notably, is wireless charging. On the other hand, with the Zenfone 8 Flip, what you get is the successor to the regular Zenfone 7 from last year. So it's a successor to the regular 7, not the 7 Pro, which is kind of an important distinction. So same base specs as before, Snapdragon 888, whatever. The rest of the spec sheet pretty much is copy-pasted over from the Zenfone 7 Pro from last year. So again, this isn't a successor to the 7 Pro, but it's taken over a lot of those sort of secondary specs from that device. So you've got a bigger screen, 5,000 mAh battery, 90 hertz refresh rate, selling for €799, whereas the regular 8 is $599. So it's the flip is a bit of a weird one. I think there's a lot of explaining that kind of needs to be done when you first mention the flip to make it clear that this isn't a successor to the 7 Pro last year, and kind of suggest that further down the line, we probably will get a Zenfone 8 Pro or Flip Pro or whatever that will, you know, be more of an actual upgrade. Because really, right now, the 8 Flip is really pretty much just a 7 Pro with a new processor. So the 8, I think, is a really compelling sort of small form factor phone. I'm not aware of anything else that's this size that has this sort of loadout of specs. I don't think that's particularly common. And with the 8 Flip, bit of a weird one. It's not really sort of the full upgrade you might have been hoping for from the Zenfone 7 Pro last year. Still, you know, very much decent. You've got three cameras around the back. You can take wide-angle selfies. It looks way better than just about any other phone. But I think if you're looking for a phone that really gives you the best of everything and also those flip cameras, probably you're going to be waiting possibly for like a Zenfone 8 Pro or 8 Flip Pro sometime later in the year.
Do we actually think that's happening?
They gave me a no comment on that, but they gave me the kind of no comment that's closer to a yes than a no. They didn't just deny it. And there have been rumors in recent weeks and months that there is a third device on the way from these guys.
All right. So I guess the question is, when I read your review and I read other people's reviews, the 8 was the more interesting product, even if it was the more traditional form factor. And for what you mentioned, you're getting a Pixel 5 form factor with much more powerful hardware, and Asus seems to kind of understand that people want a powerful small phone The cameras are not great, but they do the job. It's got a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. It basically has everything but wireless charging. It's just a well-rounded phone for not a lot of money. Why do you, irrespective of whether it's available widely in the US, why do people choose a Zen phone today? What is the compelling argument for buying an Asus smartphone over something like something from Xiaomi or Oppo that offers phones at similar price points in the markets Asus actually sells in?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, in either the two previous years, the answer to that would be the flip camera. That was the one thing Asus had that no one else had. This year, it's more like, well, the Zenfone series still kind of is the flip camera, but also we're making smaller phones because no one else is really making smaller phones. So there's that as well. I mean, also their cameras have gotten pretty good. The one thing to mention with the difference between these two cameras, the regular 8 has optical stabilization in its main camera, whereas the flip doesn't. So that's kind of a point of distinction there. But you also don't get telephoto in the regular 8. So I think it's kind of hard to sort of latch onto one thing that an Asus phone does better than the competition. You could maybe point to the software. Their software is really solid. It's pretty much what OxygenOS used to be. It's much less opinionated about its design. It's much closer to stock Android, and there's basically, you know, there is no bloat. There are very few preloaded apps. But if you're talking software, you also have to talk software updates, and that's been an area where they've been pretty slow the past year. They had a beta process for the ROG phone, I think, and both Zenfone 7s. That was running for a long time, but it took them something like 6 months from the start of that to actually release it onto normal people's devices. So it's a tricky one. I would still point to the flip camera as being probably the most compelling thing that you just can't get with any other phone. But obviously they're trying to branch out with this new Zenfone 8 into the market where there's not a whole lot of competition for a phone that still has all the power that you want, but is basically smaller than everything else. It's Pixel 5 sized.
But the software updates thing is real. I'm still waiting for Android 4 on my original Zenfone. They told me it's coming.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for Android 9 Pie on my BlackBerry Key 1. So I'm not sure when that's happening.
That ain't happening. That company went out of business.
Oh, but didn't you hear? They're making a new 5G powered BlackBerry this year, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the ROG phone too, but obviously that is a very different experience. It's just overkill, overkill squared. But Asus seems to be holding back a little bit here. The Zenfone 8 Flip, I like the form factor. I think that what you mentioned as well is that because you have precise control over the camera angle in any app, in any app, including third-party camera apps, you do have a lot more control over getting really interesting shots. And yes, it's a regression in some ways in terms of the actual camera hardware. It's the same sensors without OIS this year over the Zenfone 7 Pro. But just the experience of using that camera really is compelling, especially as somebody who likes taking interesting angles, photos at interesting angles. And I know, Alex, you're a big mobile photographer. So what are the kinds of things that you can do with the Zenfone Flip series that you can't really do with other phones?
The big one probably is kids and pets. And if you ever try to take a photo of any animal ever, basically, you'll know that getting down sort of on your hands and knees and trying to frame them up often will spook them. It's much easier if you can just kind of hold the phone down, have the camera at sort of like a 90-degree angle, and just sort of frame it from up above. You can get much more natural-looking shots that way. You'd also get some interesting shots, like low perspectives of landscapes, especially like beach scenes, waves, that kind of thing. You can get right down into the water without, getting on your hands and knees and you know, getting soaked potentially. So there's that as well. Of course, you got to remember this isn't a water resistant phone. The hinge there is the single reason it isn't. So you got to be pretty careful. But yeah, there are plenty of examples of scenes where, you know, being able to point it in a different direction to just the way you're facing can, you know, can give you plenty of opportunities.
Yeah.
You know what I would have liked to have seen? You remember when, what was it? Vivo or Oppo made that phone with like a 3-degree gimbal in the camera. Asus, this is your chance to shine. You have that flip camera, make it flip a little bit easier and put an actual motorized gimbal in it. Charge $1,500 for it, and I'd buy one.
I think you lost them at $1,500 that
year. Yeah,
you lost me at $1,500.
I just that's the first thing I think of when I see those flip around cameras is, why does nobody put a gimbal on there?
Because they're big and they don't really add too much, as we saw with the Vivo X.
Yeah, but that was only like a 2-degree or 3-degree vertical. It wasn't a real gimbal. They just used the word.
It was. It was a physical gimbal. I mean, it wasn't like the LG Wing that just used software cropping to emulate
but
a gimbal.
It might as well.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, I'm excited about these phones. If you know, if for no other reason than I like the fact that Asus is still taking phone production seriously, you know. It's the only Taiwanese manufacturer anymore that really gives a crap. HTC is certainly not in that boat anymore. So yeah, I like it. We'll talk a little bit about the Echo Buds second gen. Jeremy Johnson reviewed these. I don't have them, but he really likes them. He said that they improve every aspect of the first gen. They're smaller, they're more comfortable, they have better sound than ANC, they are cheaper, they're $100. So really, no reviews I read on these products criticize them heavily, and Amazon probably has a hit on its hand. You know, we talk about Amazon undercutting its competition with white label products. This is sort of like that, but not really, because there's a bit of actual R&D that goes into making proprietary, you know, active noise cancellation algorithms and implementing them into a really, really tight space. However, at $100, this is a really compelling product and undercuts Samsung, Jabra, Apple, basically everybody. So that's interesting to me. And I really look forward to trying these. You know, other than that, I mean, there's Harish reviewed the Xiaomi Mi Band 6 this week, and he really liked it. Although, again, it's a Mi Band, not a ton different from previous generations. It's still cheap and cheerful. I want to end the show on this Matter thing because it's a little confusing. But basically, the Smart Home Initiative, formerly known as CHIP or Project Connected Home over IP, and we should have known that this would have been rebranded because it had the word project in front of it, is now called Matter. Signify, which owns Philips Hue, is on board, as are a bunch of other companies. The organization overseeing it used to be called the Zigbee Alliance. It is now called the Connectivity Standards Alliance. This is insanely confusing. But for all intents and purposes, this is the smart home standard that Apple, Google, and Amazon, the three biggest players in the space, all agree on. And that is a significant step towards unification of smart home devices, especially since it seems, because Signify said in a press release this week that it would send an over-the-air update to all of its Philips Hue products that will allow it to work with Matter. So it seems to be, because these products already support Zigbee, it will just be a matter of flipping a switch, and once a bunch of other products support Matter, they will all be able to talk to each other. Once the smart hubs you buy, the Nest Hub, the HomePod Mini, the Amazon Echoes, once they support Matter, these products will not need a hub. They will just connect directly to those smart speakers or displays or whatever. So if it works as the, I have to keep scrolling up, the Connectivity Standard Alliance claims it will work, I think, Jerry, this might actually be something people want.
it's definitely something that people want, and it's something that companies like Philips Hue wants. I just don't see it happening. Can you think of any reason that Google and Amazon and Apple and Samsung would want to make their competitors' products work better on their platform?
Yes. No. Yes, I do. I think from a security perspective, they want, especially Apple, especially Google and Amazon, they want their respective smart home ecosystems to be perceived as being as secure as HomeKit. HomeKit does not support nearly as many products, but it has this reputation of being more secure. And because of that, consumers like it. I think this will put them all on the same level. I think it is no longer an advantage to have more companies supporting your system, because there are so many smart home vendors now. It's really difficult to keep track of which companies support which platforms. And for all intents and purposes, Amazon is winning that one. So Google wants to be in on the game on the security side. They want to be in on the game on the compatibility side. And I think everybody is just tired of competing on support. They want to compete on features. And once the baseline infrastructure is laid, they can then worry about, okay, how do we make Google Assistant more interesting with a Philips Hue bulb? Or how do we make routines work better when you don't have to go through if this, then that to actually get this outlier product working properly with my smart blinds or my smart door lock or something? Like, I think we're at a point now where even the platform owners are just tired of incompatibility. And if that is the case, then Matter is going to be a big deal.
The platform owners have no issue with incompatibility. Companies like Philips scramble to make their stuff work for both Amazon and Google. Maybe not so much Samsung and Apple, although with Apple, there's a pretty hefty, you know, approval process things have to go through. So that's a separate matter. But this isn't a lot of work, and it's something that Google could easily do. I just don't see the incentive when every company like Philips or every company that makes a camera or a door lock or whatever already makes sure it's compatible with all of Google's products. Why should Google think they need to do more work?
Well, I think Google wants to get in on it, as I said, because they want more products compatible with its ecosystem. I think what we're also seeing is that companies like Signify, which owns Philips, IKEA, which is an increasingly important part of the smart home conversation, they are now having more influence in adding to these standards, right? When you have huge companies that are selling products to end users, they get more say. Because if your Philips Hue does not work with your Amazon Echo, or if your IKEA smart bulb does not work with your Google Home, that is a problem for Google.
They both do, because they want you to buy their products. They do the work already. They right. want it to be easier.
They want it to be more interoperable. I think the issue right. here is that interoperability has been the problem. Compatibility, not so much, but with Zigbee and Z-Wave and Thread and Bluetooth, right? There's just no obvious way for all of these products to work together, so that Google has had to cobble together, as has Amazon, all of these routine style systems where if I unlock my door with my smart lock, it will turn on my lights and lift my blinds and set a timer and start, you know, dinner and whatever. And that's difficult when everything uses a different standard, or at least variances of the same standard, and it's not all reliable. And I know from my experience, like, I've got a bunch of smart plugs that just don't work all the time with Google Assistant. So I have a Miros plug and a what's it called? The one owned by Netgear. I forget. I have two different brands of plugs. They ostensibly work with Google Assistant. I say, hey, G, enable my smart plugs. That's supposed to turn on a bunch of lights when I'm shooting video. sometimes one of them works, sometimes the other one works, sometimes both of them work. And it's really not clear why one of them works at one time and one of them. So I think this is just trying to solve that baseline problem of like these products need to do a better job talking to each other.
But I just don't, what I'm saying is the initiative is coming from the companies that make your smart plugs.
No, it's coming from all of them. It's coming from Amazon, Apple, Google, and SmartThings, which are the two, which are the four biggest platform holders.
Which have not sent out any update to enable this at all.
They don't have to.
They do. This is, if they want to adopt a new standard, they have to integrate it into their software. I want it to happen. I don't mean to sound cynical. I just don't trust Google and Amazon in particular to be on board as full as they should be. Let's put it that way. I just don't trust them. They want to lock you in, and this is the exact opposite. So I want it to happen, but I'm very skeptical.
I don't know. I just think that companies are tired of fighting.
Yeah, sure. And people are tired of fighting. I get that completely. This does a lot to help that. But when you have to depend on Google and Amazon in particular, man, I sound really bad hard on those two companies. But rightfully so, they don't like to make things easier very often. And this would make it easier. So I'm very...
I'm encouraged
skeptical.
Because I see the companies that are involved in this, and they are both the end user companies like Assa Abloy, which owns Yale and a whole bunch of smart lock companies. There's Nanoleaf, there's Schlage, there's Schneider Electric, Signify. You know, those are the companies that will sell you the products or provide the chips like Texas Instruments and, you know, a whole bunch of the other ones. Then there's Google, Apple, SmartThings, which is Samsung, and Amazon, right? All of the companies that we care about being involved in this are here. So anyway, we'll see. They're going to start rolling out later this year. You may be right, Jerry. It may all fall down and be terrible, but I don't think so. I think it's using the right protocols, right? It's using existing Ethernet protocol. It's using existing low energy Bluetooth protocols. It's using Wi-Fi. It's using the right things. So it's not trying to launch a brand new protocol.
Right. And this is a big deal. Do you want your Nest thermostat to work with your Amazon Echo? Because this is how you do that. And a lot of people would like something like that to happen. So this is a really, really good thing. I don't trust big companies. I guess that's just wired inside me.
But that's a good point. The last thing I will say about that is obviously Google and Amazon, because Google owns Nest and Amazon owns Ring, they are incentivized to keep people in their ecosystems. What this will do is not necessarily make your Nest work really well with your Amazon Echo, because there's still that top layer of software that Amazon would have to build in, or Google would have to negotiate with Amazon to allow them to support, which likely won't happen. But just at a protocol level, if they both support Thread or they both support Wi-Fi, they should just be able to handshake and see each other. And that will make for a less messy, interdirectional set of communications over a router or a hub or something. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that magically Apple, Google, Samsung, and Amazon are going to wake up and all of their products are going to start working well overnight.
At least if this would all go into effect like we've envisioned it and heard so far, remember how well your Nest used to work with your Echo? It'll work that well again. It may not be as integrated as it is with a Google Home Hub, but it'll go back to working good instead of just kind of...
just not working at all, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I think we're going to leave the Matter conversation there for now. We will have more to say about it later this year. Let's go to what's making us happy this week, because we've already kind of droned on a little bit long. I will start with you, Alex. What is making you happy this week?
So what's making me happy this week, or I guess prior to this week, because we finished it now, but it's a little game called... Little Nightmares 2. It is on, I think, all consoles, PC, and also Stadia. So it's a puzzle platformer, kind of 2D/3D, but with kind of a neat sort of horror theme to it. A lot longer than you would expect for what seems to be, you know, a very sort of indie-esque sort of title, but it's a lot of fun. There are a lot of sort of tense moments, but the pacing is really nice. The aesthetic style of it is really cool. And if you like, you know, if you're into sort of puzzle platformers, that kind of thing, I think it's something you probably enjoy too.
I've heard about that. I wanted to play it, but I'm a little scared of games like that, but...
It's not too bad. The horror's pretty mild. There are some like unsettling sort of characters, let's call them. But yeah, it's good overall.
All right, thank you. That's Little Nightmares 2, available on all consoles. Ara, what is making you happy?
Let's see. We're almost done with Strawberry Season. I'm through most of the animes this season. Oh yeah, Critical Role was really great last night. They're getting close to the end of Campaign 2, so it'll be interesting to see what Campaign 3 brings. Last night's episode was great, although the ending of this campaign has been a little body horror heavy, and I'm not really into that, but the combat has been fun, and the dynamics of it have been very interesting. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing what the hell happens next week.
I don't know what Critical Role is. You talk about that a lot, and I've never asked you that.
Okay, Critical Role is a Dungeons & Dragons, it's a tabletop role-playing game, Critical Role is a group of voice actors that play Dungeons & Dragons on camera for people. So they're all voice actors, they're all really great, so they put on really great voices. Like, the game is run by Matthew Mercer, and Matthew Mercer is just, like, amazing with the diversity of voices that he can come up with for characters. And then you have some very interesting puzzles at times. You have very interesting combat at times, and tons of really immature humor from Laura Bailey and Sam Riegel.
So it's a podcast.
They do have it as a podcast. It streams once a week on Twitch, and now it streams on YouTube, which is great because the YouTube app is a little bit better than Twitch if you're just trying to watch it on a TV. So it's been really fun. It's something that I can put on in the background and then just look up whatever they have, like combat or something visually interesting. And the rest of the time I can just keep my head down and keep writing.
Got it. Okay. That makes a bit more sense. For some reason, I always thought it was an anime and you were talking about it as like a show you watched every week.
No. It's an American made tabletop playthrough.
My bad. I should have looked this up, but I didn't. So I'm glad you explained that to me. All right.
If you want to burn 200 hours, feel free to watch.
I have better things to do with 200 hours, which I will explain in a second, actually. Jerry, what is making you happy?
I know a lot of people listening to this know what BlueStacks is for Windows. Here lately, I've been working a lot inside my office, and I have a big Windows computer in front of me, but most of the time I run Linux on it. And JennyMotion is like BlueStacks for Linux. And I've always been skeptical of this kind of stuff. I tried BlueStacks when it first came out, but I went ahead and installed it earlier this week. And it's really neat. I can run a lot of Android apps right here on my desktop, and it thinks it's a Galaxy S8 Plus or S9 Plus. And it works with the Play Store. It's really kind of cool. And now I see the appeal. And it's probably something a lot of you would like to try. If you have a Windows computer, download BlueStacks. I think BlueStacks works for Mac as well. But on Linux, it's JennyMotion. It does the same thing. And you can enjoy the love and hate of Android apps on a desktop, you know, size screen like everybody with a Chromebook or a tablet has been.
That does sound pretty intriguing. That's all free?
Yeah. And I'm not going to lie, I did it. There's a game I like to play called Dungeon Village. And I was tired of grabbing my phone and just, you know, checking in on my little village. So I'm like, I'm going to, you know, try this Samsung crap and get it on my desktop. So I did a quick Google search and I'm like, I think I'm going to do it this way instead. And I did it and it works and it's kind of cool.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Say the name again.
It's BlueStacks for PC or Windows and Mac, and JennyMotion for Linux.
JennyMotion. Got it. All right. Well, what's making me happy this week is the same thing that was making me happy last week. I told everybody, if you were listening, that I got an Oculus Quest 2. I had not opened it at that point, and that a couple days later, I opened it. I spent some time in it. I bought two games, which one is 11. It's a tabletop. It's a ping pong game. And the other is Beat Saber, which everybody has heard of if you know anything about VR. 11 is the craziest shit I've ever heard, I've ever played in my life. It is a physics-accurate ping pong game that you play with other people in real time. It is the, I've never done that. I swear to God, this is the most mind-blowing thing. I'm playing live ping pong on a real-sized table in my office. I'm a pretty good ping pong player in real life. So I would know if something doesn't feel right. The haptics are right. The ball weight is right. The way that the ball hits the paddle is correct. I mean, there's a couple of things that I would do better, especially like slicing the ball does not feel right all the time, but you can topspin, you can slice. I've never done anything in VR that made me feel as immersed as this. And I love it. It is my new thing. Once I'm done work, I decompress by playing a couple of rounds of ping pong on the Quest 2. And if you have a 11, let me know, because I will play you. I'm so excited about this. I've also tried Beat Saber, which is great, as everybody has said. It's fun. It's a good workout. I've also subscribed to Supernatural for the 30-day trial, which is the workout platform that was started by a company called Within. If you haven't listened to the Decoder episode where Nilay Patel interviews the CEO of Within, I would highly recommend it, even if you're not into VR. It's just a really interesting episode about the business of VR right now. And it's fantastic. So I haven't tried very much. I played dodgeball in a game called Rec Room, which is kind of like just a free-to-play open metaverse that you can do a lot of stuff in, which was weird because I had 9-year-olds calling me names, which happens if you're in an open multiplayer world where children are allowed in. But yeah, I've just been really having fun with the Quest 2. So the specific what's making me happy is 11, a ping pong game available on the Quest, but overall just the platform itself has been fantastic. All right, that is it for the show this week. We will be back with a special Google I.O. specific episode next week, probably coming out Wednesday, so stay tuned for that. If you have any questions, let us know. We love hearing from you, podcast@androidcentral.com. If you would, take some time to share our show with a friend who may enjoy it. We really appreciate it. You can find Jerry at GB Hill. You can find Ara at Ara Wagco. You can find Alex at Alex Dobie. You can find me at Journey Dan. You can find all of us at androidcentral.com. And we will see you next week very soon. All right. Have a great weekend, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
See you later.
Adios.